From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Media land is drowning in red ink. Like, that's new. NPR just let go 7% of its workforce, canceling the program's day-to-day and news and notes. The New York Times announced plans to borrow $250 million against its building. The Tribune Company, owners of the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Baltimore Sun, declared bankruptcy. We could do this every week. All over the country, at papers large and small, budgets have been slashed, journalists have lost their jobs. The avalanche of pink slips has writer Mark Pinsky thinking about the last Great Depression, when thousands of wordsmiths were put to work on the Federal Writers Project. Created in 1935 as part of Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration, the Writers Project, at least in Pinsky's view, is ripe for resurrection.
There are so many unemployed, displaced media workers that I think there's a place for people like us in the economic stimulus program. If President-elect Obama is going to reach back to the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, from the 1930s as a model or a partial model for his economic stimulus program, he might look to a component called the Federal Writers Project.
So compare and contrast the original Federal Writers Program with the one that you propose.
I guess I would call mine the Federal Writers Project light. Unlike the original program, which had a fairly large staff in each state, which paid people on an hourly basis in an ongoing way, what I envision is something somewhere between the Pell Education Grants and the National Endowment for the Humanities and National Endowment for the Arts, which is to say, relatively modest grants that would be based on a project, not on an hourly basis. This would not provide people with jobs per se, but these would be projects that would be research projects, mostly interviews that would be approved and put out by community colleges and universities. By having community colleges particularly, and universities as well, be the sort of administrators, I think that would keep it from being too elitist, for example, and it would fill academic needs and societal needs that these institutions that are pretty close to the ground would need.
And you suggest certain topics, areas for writing that I guess are intentionally reminiscent of the kind of work that was supported 60 years ago.
That's correct. The Federal Writers Project went to people like sharecroppers, for example, or factory workers, for example, or most notably, those surviving American slaves, 2,300 surviving American slaves who were interviewed in depth and in detail and became part of a 17-volume series. I think there are many people whose lives are worthy of documenting that otherwise the economics of the news business would not suggest that would be possible.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, one thing that really interests me is the changing complexion of America, literally. That is the modern immigrant experience. I think it's often part of a polarized debate, but I would be interested, and I think America ultimately would be interested in the stories of these immigrants who have come and how they've made their way. But there are other ways. I mean, President-elect Obama talks about the transition to a green economy. I think it would be interesting if that happens to have some people out there actually documenting how that transition has worked. And at the same time, I think we're in the midst of, I guess we can call, a great recession. And I think that's something that's meritorious of some attention as well.
Now, in the comments section following the story you did in the New Republic, you had at least three different people suggesting that maybe journalists should pick up shovels if they're looking for work. And, you know, in a way, you have to understand that reaction a little at a time when everyone's screaming for bailouts and helping hand dollars. Are college graduated J-school grads the ones who should be getting the bucks? I mean, during the Depression, a lot of reporters were working class, but that's not the case anymore. How would you argue that this isn't special pleading?
I think people should be able to use their skills in a way that would help the country in the best way. People are literally out on the street with no income in some cases. And I think a modest program, which would be kind of a transitional thing for them, or and not just for older journalists. I think this is a program that for younger journalists or would-be journalists who might not be able to get an entry-level job because of the contraction of the industry, here would be an opportunity for them to show what they can do that would enable them to move into journalism.
You know, the producer of this segment, Megan Ryan, says that maybe this idea of yours isn't about protecting individual writers, but about saving the fourth estate. But I, for one, I'm not sure that the Fourth Estate needs saving. Maybe it's just the newspaper and the magazine industries that failed to keep up with the times that need saving. I don't think that we're seeing the end times of good journalism.
I would disagree. When you see not only these major catastrophic cuts in newspapers and magazines, if you look around, you see it elsewhere in the economy as well, elsewhere in the new media. All these news websites that were going to really make a change, they've had cutbacks too. I think there's something more fundamental at work here.
We're in a recession. Everybody is cutting back. There are some websites that are doing incredibly good work and are not suffering unduly because of that good work.
Well, I would suggest that some of this predates the actual recession. I think there is a disengagement in our population. People are not being engaged because they feel they don't have to be engaged.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Brooke. I appreciate it.
You can find Mark Pinsky's plan for a new federal writers project on the New Republic online.
The original federal writers project was run by Henry Alsberg as part of Federal Project Number 1, which also included the Historical Record Survey, the Federal Theater Project, the Federal Music Project, and the Federal Art Project. Here's Zora Neale Hurston on a song she picked up in the Bahamas and preserved as part of the project.
What kind of a song is this, Zora?
This is a Nassau song from the Bahamas.
When is it used?
Well, they sing the song when they're jumping the fire dance.
What is the fire dance?
The fire dance is some sort of African survival in the West Indies, and they beat the drums and sing these little songs.
And how did you happen to learn it?
Well, I was doing research down there collecting songs on the Columbia University, and I collected quite a few of them, and this is just one of them. Mr. Brown, I want your daughter. Oh, Mr. Brown, coat on like a lady. Oh, Mr. Brown, young lady. Oh, Mr. Brown.
Writers who collected interviews and information about their own multifarious Americas included Conrad Aiken, Saul Bellow, John Cheever, John Steinbeck, and I'll let Gerald Hirsch, author of A Portrait of America, A Cultural History of the Federal Writers Project, pick it up from there.
Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright. The Writers Project was set up to find a program that would employ not only creative writers, but people who had skills beyond doing infrastructure. There were unemployed librarians, lawyers, teachers, and journalists and writers. Most of the people on the project had to come off the relief rolls.
Now, 6,600 people mainly plucked from the relief rolls to do what?
To rediscover America, to give us a new and broader knowledge of the very country we lived in, and not to see it in narrow, exclusive terms of just the dominant culture. The things they concentrated on were the American Guide series, a comprehensive and encyclopedic guide to every state in the Union. But they're also well known for the interviews with former slaves, interviews with textile workers in the South, with the idea of the national office called Introducing America to Americans.
Now, it is conventional wisdom that when the federal bureaucracy gets involved in areas that hitherto had been confined to the free marketplace, that everything pretty much goes wrong. It's hard to imagine that literature would be any exception. How successful was the government in getting their work into the hands of ordinary Americans?
They were very successful in getting the guides into the hands of ordinary Americans because they realized that they were not in the position to really publish books for the public market. And they signed contracts with major publishers of the time. So they were able to get much of that stuff out. The interviews with slave narratives, the first of those did not come out until Benjamin Botkin edited a collection called Lay My Burden Down. And they were available in microfilm at the Library of Congress, but historians didn't get around to using them until the 1960s. When they began to become more interested in the slaves' perspective. So a lot of the more innovative projects did not really see publication.
I want to ask you this. If you were the Federal Writers Project czar yourself, How would you deploy the writers and researchers and editors and historians at your disposal to produce what is not produced by the free market of literary ideas?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mention that because at one point the National Endowment for the Humanities under Bill Clinton was headed by William Ferris, who is a folklorist and American studies person. He had in mind grants for regional encyclopedias and state encyclopedias with much of the same idea of rediscovering the diversity we're often unaware of in America, having a record of the lives of people who often get neglected. So I would say that that would seem to me a worthwhile thing to do.
You could be describing Studs Terkel's career.
Right.
And he's a veteran of the Federal Writers Project.
Right. Well, one of the things that the people at the Writers Project thought in the national office, and they were more liberal, but they thought that if Americans, through the project and on the project, became more in touch with the grassroots and everyday life, defining culture in that way, it would lead to a renaissance in American literature and a revival in American arts that could build on that.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Gerald Hirsch is author of Portrait of America, A Cultural History of the Federal Writers Project, and professor of history at Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri.
Extra, extra, understand going into show business. Read all about it. Extra.
Coming up, we see conflict of interest everywhere.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For the next 6 minutes, I'll be covering the controversial broadcast of an assisted suicide. That's fair warning if you don't want to hear about it. Chris Ewart, who had a motor neuron disease, chose Beethoven's Ninth as the soundtrack for his last conscious moments. Soundtrack is the operative word here because director John Zaritsky filmed those moments for a documentary that aired in Britain on Sky TV's Real Lives channel Wednesday night. In the film, originally called The Suicide Tourist, then retitled Right to Die, Chris Ewart, accompanied by his wife and a suicide assistant, drinks a lethal dose of a barbiturate, turns his ventilator off with his mouth, and peacefully slips away.
Okay, can I give you a big kiss?
Of course.
Okay, I love you.
I love you, sweetheart. Oh, so much.
Okay. I have a safe journey. And I'll see you sometime.
He died 2 years ago in Zurich, where assisted suicide is legal under some conditions. It is not legal in Canada, where it aired without much controversy more than a year ago. And it's not legal in Britain, where the broadcast generated so much anticipatory anxiety and outrage that Prime Minister Gordon Brown was compelled to address the gathering storm in Parliament.
Does the Prime Minister regard this program as being in the public interest, or is it simply distasteful voyeurism?
Mr. Speaker, these are very difficult issues. I think it's very important that these issues are dealt with sensitively and without sensationalism. And I hope broadcasters remember that they have a wider duty to the general public. And of course, it will be a matter for the television watchdogs when the broadcast is shown.
Ofcom, the government's television watchdog, will consider whether the provisions on harm and offense have been breached. Its code states that methods of suicide and self-harm must not be included in programs except where they are editorially justified and also justified by the context. It could, potentially, impose a fine on Sky of up to £250,000. But Ewart directed his comments to the moral watchdogs he expected to offend.
There are people who will look at this and say, no, suicide is wrong. You cannot play God and take your own life. All right, fine, but you know what? This ventilator is playing God.
Ewart said he chose this death because he could control it.
If I go through with it, I die, as I must at some point. If I don't go through with it, my choice is essentially to suffer and to inflict suffering on my family.
The vast majority of patients, and the evidence supports this with motor neuron disease, do not have a choking, unpleasant, suffocating death. That's just not true.
Dr. Rob George of the group Care Not Killing carried on the debate this week on Sky News.
And so I feel really sad and quite angry about that.
Britain's outspoken website Spiked was more angry than sad. Quote, however you dress it up, this was little more than a thinking man's snuff movie, an attempt to turn death into a televisual spectacle for public consumption. It was deeply prurient, preying on our baser rubbernecking desires to watch the unwatchable, car crash TV of another sort.
You know, a lot of people turn their head and look at a car accident. I don't think we have to televise that every Sunday night at 7 o'clock.
That's Ned McGrath of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Detroit. But he wasn't talking about Craig Ewart. His remark, which aired almost exactly 10 years ago on PBS's NewsHour, was in response to a 60 Minutes story that showed Dr. Jack Kevorkian administering a lethal injection to Thomas Yoke, a 52-year-old Michigan man suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. Here's Mike Wallace with Kevorkian.
And in watching these tapes, I get the feeling there's something almost ghoulish in your desire to see the deed done.
Well, it could be. I can't argue with that. Maybe it is ghoulish. I don't know. But the main point is the last part of your statement, that the deed be done.
John Zaritsky, director of Right to Die, told a Canadian TV interviewer last year that he was determined to show the deed so that no viewer would be left to wonder if the director had manipulated it.
As difficult as I felt the experience would be for an audience, I thought it was terribly, terribly important to go through the whole thing and not to play any games or stop the camera right at the last minute.
My unscientific survey of British blog postings and websites suggests that the reactions to Wednesday's broadcast fall into three groups. Those who support assisted suicide and supported the broadcast, those who oppose assisted suicide and oppose the broadcast, and those who support assisted suicide but opposed the broadcast. Dr. Peter Saunders opposes both. He's of the group Care Not Killing, and he told the Daily Mail there is a growing appetite from the British public for increasingly bizarre reality shows. It's a slippery slope. But Ellen Laventry, posting on the American website BeliefNet, says that what Dr. Saunders fails to grasp is that this isn't a reality show. It's reality. Quote, reality shows, with their selfish behavior, manipulation, and consumerism, undermine humanitarian values and sympathy, while documentaries like this one, even if the viewer disagrees with it, do the opposite, increasing our sympathy for people in dire circumstances we pray we never have to face ourselves.
Last spring, when New York Times reporter David Barstow wrote about the ubiquity on TV news of military experts with ties to the Pentagon and military contractors, he might have thought that exposing these conflicts of interest might possibly end them. But nothing has changed, nor has there been any on-air acknowledgement by the networks of a problem.
General, every time you come back from one of your trips, we get a three-ring binder containing your findings. That is to say, you've covered it so closely and analyzed it. How do you see the future of Iraq?
Well, objectively, the snapshot is extremely good. I mean, the violence is...
That's retired four-star Army General Barry McCaffrey, still a paid expert on NBC News with Brian Williams. On November 29th, the Times printed a 5,000-word follow-up by Barstow, focusing on McCaffrey. Among other things, Barstow reported that the general had used his TV pulpit to advocate continuing the war in Iraq, a position he stood to profit from because of his stake in a private contractor. Charles Kaiser has been writing about the McCaffrey affair for the Columbia Journalism Review. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, Barstow, in his piece, did go to McCaffrey, and McCaffrey's defense, and I hope I'm doing him justice here, is that he was an early and frequent critic of U.S. war policy, at least in the beginning, and particularly of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's approach to the war, and that if he criticized the war, you know, ipso facto, he couldn't have been in the pocket of the Pentagon or its contractors. Does that cut ice with you?
Well, no, because it's really two different questions there. Is he in the pocket of the Pentagon or is he in the pocket of the contractors? NBC has, in its only very narrow defense of using him, has focused entirely on the fact that he was a critic of Rumsfeld's. He wasn't a critic, I don't think, of our involvement there. He was a critic of the way Rumsfeld was waging the war, as was almost every other sensible person around.
In Barstow's piece, he suggests that after McCaffrey's early criticism of Rumsfeld and the way he was waging the war, they cut him off to access to top brass. And then he kind of came around to their way of thinking and got his access back. Why was that access important to McCaffrey?
Well, two reasons, as Barstow's piece makes clear. First of all, just by having this access, you get to know what kind of military equipment and what kind of consulting services the Pentagon is looking for at that particular moment. Second of all, it gives you a chance to directly lobby individual officers about the value of the equipment McCaffrey was trying to get the Iraqis to buy.
Now, the answer you just gave me essentially assumes that McCaffrey was a pig at the trough and that he was using his credential as an NBC commentator to get access with which to advance his personal financial interests. But let's just say he behaved in a way that was above reproach and that he never abused the privilege of access with Pentagon brass for his own personal gain, okay? Is that itself a sufficient reason for NBC to use him as an independent commentator, especially without disclosure?
No. Any sensible news executive who is aware of all of these conflicts or just potential conflicts would automatically decide, this is not someone I want on my air. And that is the opposite of what NBC News has done up to and including 10 days ago when McCaffrey made his most recent appearance on NBC Nightly News, I think talking about Afghanistan.
And here's where you entered the fray. Tell me about what the network has said to you and others with respect to the McCaffrey story.
They told Barstow, we have clear policies in place to assure that the people who appear on our air have been appropriately vetted and that nothing in their profile would lead to even a perception of a conflict of interest. Now, months go by, Barstow comes back, does the story again about McCaffrey, and the Society for the Professional Journalists very sensibly decides on the basis of what they've read twice in the New York Times that they should call upon NBC to stop using McCaffrey.
But NBC instead, I guess, kind of attacked the Society of Professional Journalists for depending on the Times story as the sole basis for its complaint.
Yeah, and they actually accused the Ethics Committee of coming to its conclusion without, quote, seeking any information or facts from NBC News. And I reported that statement, which NBC gave me yesterday, only to find out that, in fact, SPJ did go to NBC before making any statement. They did ask for NBC's opinion, and NBC ignored two emails and two phone calls requesting their comment.
There is on the NBC News website, under, I guess, the biography of General McCaffrey, some listing of his board memberships, but not necessarily his client list at his consulting firm.
No, they haven't even done that much. What they've done is they have a link on the NBC site to McCaffrey's site, and they said to Barstow, since we have a link to his site and since his site lists all of his clients, we've disclosed this. However, Barstow, making the elementary move of going to McCaffrey's site, discovered that, in fact, he does not list his clients on his own site.
Now, you've been hammering this day by day in your blog. What's your latest from NBC?
The latest statement I got back from NBC was they hadn't actually lied to me yesterday when they attacked SPJ for not contacting them in advance because In their view, SBJ had already made up their mind when they got contacted, and therefore there was no point in NBC responding in any way.
Aha. An airtight case. Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Charlie Kaiser writes the Full Court Press blog for the Columbia Journalism Review. That's cjr.org. We called NBC News, and it said it stood by its statement that the Society of Professional Journalists had, quote, rushed to judgment in a way NBC found, quote, unfortunate and irresponsible. We also called General McCaffrey, whose spokesman said the New York Times piece was, quote, largely innuendo, and that, quote, the reporter seemed bent on an agenda. He added that the general is motivated by improving our national security wherever he has served in the public or private sectors. Speaking of conflict of interest and hearkening back to the wave of layoffs sweeping the media industry, here's something to chew on. Dan Abrams, former general manager of MSNBC, has launched a new media strategy firm called Abrams Research. The plan is to make former journalists and those currently employed available to corporations as consultants, which would seem to spell all sorts of trouble. But Dan says it makes sense. A typical client, he says, might be
anything from someone who thinks that they've been treated unfairly by the financial media, let's say, and they want advice on how can we better convey our message to an American business that wants information about the German sports media, let's say. They're thinking about expanding their brand, and they want German sports media people. It's targeted, it's specific, and it's going to be lower cost because they don't have to retain us over a long period of time.
Now, I just want to get this straight. Abrams Research isn't just a network of former journalists. It includes active bloggers and employees of news organizations right now.
Right. But let's be careful. We will not be using anyone whose contract prevents them or their employee manual prevents them from doing.
Okay, well, that will probably reduce the pool of potential consultants by, you know, some large percentage, because most news organizations do have ethics policies which limit the amount of any kind of freelancing their employees can do, especially PR.
That's right. But think about it. There are a lot of people who are freelance, on the other hand. What I want is people who are available and who are allowed to do outside work. And I think there are a lot of people out there. This is not just a community of journalists. This is a community of media professionals.
Okay, but forgive me for focusing on the journalists, because the idea of someone who's a working journalist doing any—
How do you define working?
Being paid by a news organization.
So anything, let's say they do an op-ed piece, right, for the New York Times, and they're paid for that op-ed piece. That person isn't allowed to do any consulting?
I'm not sure.
No, I mean,
Dan Abrams, the lawyer.
No, I mean, but
there's another thing, Mrs. Feldstein. But you were in the room, weren't you?
No, it really does. This is why it has to be taken on a case by case basis, because there is no blanket rule that can apply here, apart from the fact that if you're not allowed to do it, you're not allowed to be part of our network.
I'm so tempted to ask you the question I asked you 5 years ago.
Go ahead. For the listeners who weren't there back then.
Yeah, for the listeners who weren't there when I spoke to Dan last about his show on MSNBC, which had essentially become the All Scott Peterson show all the time, I said, Dan, you're a lawyer. You have a great journalistic tradition in your family. Are you sure this is how you want to be making a living? So let me run it past you again. There are other ways to get advice to a corporate clientele.
What's the matter with the media doing it?
Are you sure this is how
Sounds like once you touch journalism, you can't work in any other industry. You know why? Because then you're a sellout. I argue no. No, these are really smart folks who are in the media. And I think that they can do a whole lot of different things.
Why do all those employment manuals explicitly prohibit news organization employees from working on the side in PR?
This is not just a business about PR. This is all different things related to media. Let's talk about someone who used to be a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. There's a business that's thinking about acquiring an oil and gas business. I hire that person and say, this business wants a report on this oil and gas business they're thinking about acquiring. I found a really smart person who knows a lot about the oil and gas industry, who spent 20 years writing about it, who left the Chronicle a few years back, and is going to write a report for this business on something they're thinking about acquiring. Problem?
No. God bless you. God bless him. God bless us everyone. But if he's working for the Chronicle, even if he's covering education or manufacturing or the police beat, I don't want him engaged in public relations.
Well,
then I don't know what his motives are for any single thing he does, including going easy on an existing news source for fear that he's a potential future client.
And what if he wrote an op-ed piece for the Houston Chronicle on some particular issue, and the Houston Chronicle paid that person for that op-ed piece? Are you saying that person then can't consult?
I don't know.
Here's the point. You want it to be black and white. I'm saying that it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. But I think that some people are simply horrified at the idea of members of the media making some money. The idea that media folks would actually be able to make some money, it's awful, I know.
I can't even imagine it. It certainly never happened to me. Dan, as always, thank you very much.
Bob, my pleasure.
You're a gamer.
It's always a lot of fun.
Dan Abrams is former general manager and host at MSNBC and founder of Abrams Research.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the U.S., conflict of interest in journalism is an occupational hazard, a product of greed or need, or most often too much coziness between reporter and source. But in Japan, it's encouraged and institutionalized through a network of press clubs. Here in the U.S., a press club is a place stocked with a bar, journalists, and the occasional newsmaker. But in Japan, press clubs, they call them kisha clubs, are like in-house PR units. There are thousands of them located inside every office you can imagine. Government agencies, political parties, businesses, even consumer groups. Outsiders are barred, and membership is exclusive, open only to journalists from major newspapers and networks. The organizations that host these clubs also rule them to a certain extent. We sent OTM producer Mark Phillips to Tokyo to take a look around.
The media in Japan has its share of paradoxes. For instance, circulation numbers are huge here. In fact, Japan's top five papers are in the top 10 worldwide. And the most read paper, the Yomiuri Shimbun, has the world's biggest circulation, almost twice USA Today, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times combined. The paradox? The Japanese, who read more papers per capita than anyone, except Norwegians, almost always describe their newspapers as boring.
They go, Prime Minister Aso woke up at X hour in the morning. He took a walk for 4 minutes and 30 seconds. He's headed for the bar at the Imperial Hotel at night. He eats a hamburger, etc., etc.
Takashi Uesugi, a freelance journalist in Tokyo, is author of the book The Collapse of Journalism, which blasts Japan's kisha clubs. And he's in a position to know. He started his career as a reporter working inside the kisha club system, but then left to work in the government.
When I was on the politician's side, I thought, wow, what a convenient system. Oh, I utilize it every day.
Uesugi was a political aide in the Liberal Democratic Party, the conservative party that's held uninterrupted power here since 1955, minus a few months in 1993. When Uesugi needed to release bad news, he spoke only to the press inside the party's kisha club, where a club dynamic ensures one reporter doesn't print the story ahead of the pack.
They like the convoy system. No one should stand out. If you are the only one who gets the scoop, you are given the cold shoulder. If you are the only one who doesn't write it, then you are condemned by your company.
To safeguard against accidental initiative, members of a kisha club, reporters from different papers, share notes in a practice called memo matching. It often results in newspapers printing identical stories. One night I saw three evening papers lead with an identical headline. In fact, two out of three even had the same sub-headline. The fear of being last, or first, ensures that the press club reporters release information in lockstep. So Uesugi sneaks into the Liberal Democratic Party's kisha club, as well as the prime minister's, posing as a secretary.
When they find me, they throw me out. One time, for example, the manager of the kisha club approached me and said, "Why are you here? Who gave you permission?" I told him, oh, I got lost and I just found myself in here. And they said, don't give us that crap. Get the hell out. If we see you next time, we'll report you to the police for trespassing. Well, I still sneak in there anyway. There are a number of ways, but I cannot get into that.
It sounded fun, so I snuck into a private Keisha club myself. I promised my guide not to say which one, but like all such clubs, it was located inside the agency the reporters were supposed to be covering, with separate sections for print and broadcast. It's reminiscent of a summer camp or a college dorm with bunk beds that double as desks, run-down furniture with cigarette burns, and baseball trophies on top of file cabinets. In one corner, there are four TV screens always on. Outside the curtain is a common area with vending machines and beaten-up coffee tables. With morning and evening editions to write for, many reporters spend days on end inside the club. And the agency's PR room is just a few doors down, which, critics argue, creates a too cozy environment.
It is almost equivalent to a bunch of male geisha.
Yata Suzuki was a Keisha Club member when he was a newspaper reporter. Now he writes for the weekly magazines.
The best-behaved reporters at the Keisha Club are the first to get information. All they can do is hang out with the authority, drinking sake and having fun, trying to please them.
But the bond between reporter and official runs deeper than the booze, the cigarette breaks, and the office space they share. Their whole careers are intertwined. Takashi Uesugi.
Strangely enough, if a reporter started out covering Mr. Aso when he was a foreign minister, basically the same reporter follows Mr. Aso for the rest of his life. As a pet politician rises up the food chain, so does the reporter who follows him.
In this setup, reporters play the role of protector, not investigator. Again, Takashi Uesugi.
If the reporter gets some information about this politician's rival scheming or something, he would warn him. You see, if your politician has a big downfall caused by a scandal, you have a downfall too. Maybe getting assigned to some remote area. Then you can't write anything.
Keisha Club reporters also give their politicians a heads up on what questions will be asked at the press conferences. Sometimes the answers are even typed up and given to reporters in advance, making the actual event a mere formality. I got a taste of that at the Japanese Newspaper Association, which oversees and makes guidelines for the Keisha Clubs. I submitted questions in advance, and when I arrived, seven stern-looking men were waiting for me at a long table. With harsh lights and sweaty foreheads, it felt like an interrogation scene from the movies. One of the men reached across the table, handed me a printout of the answers, and started reading them.
The answer is, see page 1, second paragraph. The answer I'm about to read is written here. This is a guideline.
Shinsuke Sano, managing editor at one of Japan's largest newspapers, and chairman of the Subcommittee on the Problems of the Keisha Clubs, is reading excerpts of the association's official guidelines in response to my question, why do Keisha Clubs exist?
Public institutions in Japan are rather reluctant to disclose information. The history of the Keisha Club is that it has functioned as a collective team to pressure them to disclose information to the journalists. The Keisha Club has been active for over a century, representing Japanese citizens who are entitled to obtain information. That's the answer to the first question.
But what about freelance reporters' complaints that journalists who aren't members of Keisha Clubs get shut out of press conferences?
There are occasions where we are the one to host a press conference, and on many of those occasions we allow freelance journalists and magazine reporters, as long as they agree to follow our rules.
And can I ask you what some of those rules are?
Shinsuke Sano paused for over a minute as the various representatives shuffled through their papers to find an official response to my ad-libbed question.
For example, they have to be magazine reporters or media reporters with long-standing careers. Other criteria, they have to have the common interest of fair reporting to be able to cooperate with the management of the club and for them to comply with our high standards for media ethics.
Then Sano handed me the canon of journalism ethics and stipulated that freelancers must prove their allegiance to its principles through their actions, an abstract requirement that effectively shuts out freelance and magazine writers. But Sano says there's nothing stopping those reporters from approaching officials directly.
If you need to speak privately to a certain individual, it would be through that individual's secretary or office, I suppose. The Keisha Club would have nothing to do with it.
That's exactly what Takashi Uesugi tried to do in 1999, when then-Prime Minister Obuchi actually said yes to his interview request.
While the office of Mr. Obuchi okayed the interview, the office had to submit the Prime Minister's daily schedule to the Cabinet Keisha Club. According to the Keisha Club, it would be a violation of the rules for me to do a one-on-one interview with Prime Minister Obuchi. I said, Prime Minister Obuchi granted me the interview himself. Why shouldn't I be able to interview him? The Keisha Club replied, rules are rules. If you want an interview, you need to belong to our organization, and only then can you reapply for a one-on-one interview. And while this was all going on, Mr. Obuchi had a stroke, got hospitalized, and passed away. And that was that.
Little has changed since. Outsiders can't get in, and insiders can't get the word out because of the club rules, including blackboard agreements, lists of stories they can't write. Shinsuke Sano at the Newspaper Association.
We don't actually have a blackboard agreement. We don't have a blackboard. How it works is that, for example, if there is a kidnapping case, in order not to interfere with the ongoing investigation, we discuss and make an agreement on keeping some information. Otherwise, as a rule, we try not to have agreements as much as possible.
Here's today's blackboard agreement. Let me show it to you.
Author and freelancer Takashi Uesugi says there are blackboard agreements handed out every day at various Keisha clubs. And he opened up his laptop to show me a leaked copy of that day's blackboard list from the Prime Minister's Club. Among various items not to be written was a bona fide blockbuster.
This was handed to me by a private secretary of Prime Minister Aso. Japan considers lending $100 billion to financial market. This is considered a scoop. However, if you went off by yourself and wrote this, you and your news organization will be banned.
And so the bailout scoop went unpublished for a couple days until the time when the blackboard agreement stipulated it could be published. Yet scoops and scandals still break in the media here. How they do it is another great paradox of Japanese journalism. Keisha Club reporters leak the stories they can't print to rival reporters at the weekly magazines. Writer Yata Suzuki is a frequent recipient.
In that context, the weekly magazines and the press club have a codependent relationship. If the stories become public knowledge by being printed in the magazines, they can then write about them in the papers.
Sometimes the Keisha Club reporters will even write the stories themselves for the weeklies. Of course, they use a pen name so as not to get fired, and because most of the weeklies are... Well, I went to a newsstand with former Tokyo crime reporter Jake Adelstein.
What are the headlines?
Some of these headlines are so offensive I can't even translate them for you.
What?
They're talking about somebody's mongrel-shaped breast.
Adelstein's assistant had to jump in to clarify.
A girl who's 15 years younger than he is with a breast that has a... It's so big, it's like mango.
Well stated. I didn't even know how to begin translating that one.
That's the main story?
Yes. The mongrel-shaped breast of the top story.
These magazines thrive on celebrity gossip and sex. Most of their covers feature very young women wearing very little, and many have actual pornography inside. It'd be like mixing the sleaziest elements of the National Enquirer and Hustler with the cultural and political analysis of the New Yorker and the Atlantic. Like this article, which was next to the piece on the mango-shaped breast.
This is a good one. This is how the Prime Minister Aso's family business has been covering up defects in the high-speed roadways that they've been building. This is how they've been covering it up. And they've got internal documents, they've got photos. This is like the stuff you would hope that Japanese newspapers would do, but probably won't.
But magazine writer Yata Suzuki says the boring newspapers seem more credible, even when they aren't.
There are many who suspect the accuracy of what the weekly magazines write, even though in actuality the weekly magazines may have higher accuracy. There are many scandals where, although they are accurate, they end up being killed by the newspapers.
How do they kill them?
By deliberately ignoring them.
Meanwhile, the public is mostly unaware of the power of the Keisha Club. Again, Yata Suzuki.
I think that 90% of the average citizens don't know. However, 100% of the people in the media do know.
And since even magazine writers and freelancers depend on club members for juicy leaks, few openly protest the club system.
Ever since my start, I had serious doubts about the Kisha Club.
Ken Takeuchi started as a political reporter in the late 60s at the Asahi newspaper. In the 90s, he ran for mayor of Kamakura City and won. In 1996, he took the controversial step of opening up the Kisha Clubs in his jurisdiction to freelance writers and foreign correspondents.
Obviously, as mayor, it would probably be advantageous for me to maintain a cozy relationship with the press. But for the sake of Japanese media itself and the Japanese citizens, I thought, let the freelancers in. Let the foreign correspondents in.
Another governor followed suit by abolishing Kisha clubs altogether throughout his entire region. The Japanese Newspaper Association continued the trend by changing their guidelines. But since the rules for each club are set by its members, the guidelines are easily brushed aside. Former Mayor Ken Takeuchi.
You can see a couple of points of improvement, however, since the amended guidelines. For example, clubs started paying their own telephone and fax bills. Also, in the old days, government employees worked in the press clubs running various errands for reporters. Most of them are not doing that, after being told to stop.
After politics, Takeuchi has gone on to start a news website called Janjan, and he's hoping it can play a similar role as The Weekly by providing a place for unreported stories to get their first airing. Although it isn't his proudest scoop, Janjan was the first place to write about Prime Minister Aso's apparent inability to read kanji, the Chinese characters used in Japanese. By all accounts, kanji is difficult, but it's still an expected skill set for the Prime Minister.
We at Janjan were the first people to write about it. All the political reporters who are following the cabinet positions and are in charge of Prime Minister Aso would know that he is making a mistake in reading kanji. But they would not write about it, considering the relationship they have with him and the Liberal Democratic Party.
After it appeared on Janjan, they did start writing about it. Takeashi Usugi sees a similar trend now that video of legislative sessions is available on the internet. Bloggers are beginning to scrutinize and discuss bills that previously went unmentioned.
It is only the beginning, but the conventional political reporters' ways where they would cover up for their politicians are now falling apart, albeit little by little.
Little being the operative word. In fact, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party has been passing privacy laws that actually make it more difficult to report on scandals. And the current leader of the opposition is no champion of the free press either. Strangely, the best hope for either opening or abolishing the Kisha clubs altogether may be the very thing we fear might ruin journalism in the U.S., a dying newspaper industry. Japan's colossal circulation figures have dropped in recent years, and a revenue crisis here could weaken the power of the Kisha clubs. That may be the biggest paradox, that the decline of newspapers could lead to a blossoming of real journalism, and Japanese newspapers might just find that printing a scoop once in a while is actually a great way to sell papers. In Tokyo for OTM, I'm Mark Phillips.
That's it for this week's show. Mark's piece was made possible by a grant from the Freeman Foundation. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Prechep and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Adding this to our good friend John Solomon, get well soon, man.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.